with one click last week, now takes two or three clicks. I notice these things, but that's all right. It's not something that's related to you or Studio Restream. It has more to do with the Chrome browser, which, you know, I shouldn't even use it. I should find another one, but that's all right. Doesn't matter.
Use the Brave browser.
There's other things happening, too. I just notice, you got to remember, I had an old obsolete computer for years until I got this one around Christmas, right? This one I'm using now. And on the old one, I had three different browsers. At one time, I had like four or five browsers, and I could always go right to the history and find something I had already looked at. But I noticed with the net browsers I have now, the same browser, you know, Chrome, Opera, Safari, what's the other one I got there?
Yeah.
They've changed the format of the history that makes it really hard. You've got to go searching for a tab that you might have just looked at an hour ago because they don't put the history in the same order.
I'm not sure if that's true.
It is. They have it nested. They have it nested in some kind of hierarchy. They've changed the format of the history page. Now, maybe it had to do with the fact that I was using on the old computer, old browsers.
Okay.
But I noticed right away, as soon as I got this new computer and downloaded the browsers and started them up, the history was just, it was a pain in the ass to go looking through the history pages there to find something I had just looked at the day or two before. Whereas on the old computer, it used to be a piece of cake. So they changed something. They change the history, the way they're storing the history.
Okay.
I notice these things, but I don't know. You wouldn't notice as much because you're using a current system, but it doesn't matter. There's no use my complaining about it. I don't know. Hey, do you want a song to open up with?
Oh, yeah. I'm not ready yet. I'm a little behind. I'm just trying to get going here.
Well, I was going to finish up Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Oh, yeah?
And what he reflects about the cult of Yehuda, or cult of Judah, as Jan Eric likes to call it. I hate using that J.
Yeah, you're a traditionalist.
The J is pronounced like a yeah, like a Y. I can't stand English and Anglo-Saxon. You know, we spend half our time explaining to people that, oh, by the way, the reason why you can't get your Bible right is because it's in fucking English. And the English is so disconnected from the original Greek, let alone the Hebrew. Forget the Hebrew. The English is so disconnected from the Greek and the Latin in pronunciation. It's in everything that it's like, it's almost like you can tell the fucking British Israelites went out of their way to create an English Bible that is so freaking obscure. And they created an English language that destroys the Latin. They bury the Latin roots of the English language. It's disgusting. It really, and you can see it in the way they name things and in the spelling. They change the spelling. It's Yehuda, yeah, not Jew. It was never Jew. It's Yahud or Juden. In German, it's Yehuden. In French, it's Juif. I don't know if they pronounce the J either. They spell it with a J.
No, I don't think so.
It's Juif. But English, oh, Jews. Everybody who's a native English speaker is going to be talking about Jews.
The Jews.
They were never called Jews until the 19th century. You know, when English got standardized, finally, and English spelling, I don't know. I shouldn't go into a rant over English. People don't realize how fucking ignorant the English language is unless you studied a foreign language. Remember the argument I had over spelling bees?
Yeah.
And why Spanish speakers, even French speakers, and French spelling is difficult, laugh at the fact that we have spelling bees. They think it's stupid. Italians too.
Really?
There are no spelling bees in those languages. There'd be no spelling bee in Latin either. And why is that? Because English spelling fucking sucks. Now, people need to understand that. So if you're an English speaker and you've never studied a Romance language or even German, which is, you know, a high European language, they all use the Latin alphabet. I got to get into a rap on this because you got a participant named Vespa Douglas who is convinced that the Romans didn't build the roads and the aqueducts and Hadrian's Wall, that the Scots did it themselves. And I'm ready to prove that that's utter bullshit because the Scots and the English couldn't even invent an alphabet of their own. Nobody in Europe has an alphabet of their own. Nobody. They all had to borrow the Latin. Or in the case of Russia and the Balkan countries, they borrowed the Greek. It's called the Cyrillic alphabet. And that's because these monks needed to translate the Bible. And so they said, well, we need an alphabet. The Vikings had something called runes, but didn't function as an alphabet for writing. Anyway, that's a whole... let me tell you, nothing has done more damage, lasting damage to the education of the young than the erasure of the Latin and Greek and the ending of the requirement that students need to study at least a little bit of Latin. They really do, in order to understand where their language came from. Because people, oh, it's the English alphabet. Oh, it's the French alphabet. Oh, it's the Spanish alphabet.
Lynn, what song?
It's the German alphabet. No, it's not. It's
the
Latin alphabet, Lynn, because those people didn't have alphabets because they were barbarians. But anyway.
What song do you want to use? Did you give it to me?
Oh, yeah. Sorry about that. It's from 1930. All right, so now I got to figure out how to open the chat.
Well, just tell me the name of it.
Well, all I got is a YouTube link.
Okay. What's the name of the track?
All right. Let me see. Now I can't find the chat. Let's
it's a little.
I can open the chat.
It says private chat at the bottom.
No, not on my screen. It doesn't.
Well, it's probably
online,
on. Move the screen up a bit.
Tune into the Fakeologist show. I see your screen.
Go below there.
Okay.
Your window must be falling off the bottom.
No, I see icons. And then I see a Restream IO messages from audience will display here. And that's it. So I got to find. No, clicked on that. Nothing happened.
With regard to language, what you hear as English and what you know as English is, in fact, the first language. That is why the script of this realm is, in fact, the KJV 1611.
That's a crock of shit.
Strictly
that's
because
a crock of shit. The Geneva Bible
and its
is
relationship
older than the KJV.
To gematria.
This is a guy who thinks he knows the Bible and he doesn't. He really doesn't.
Okay, I think he must be listening into the pre-show. Dave J is listening.
The only way to study the Bible is to study the Septuagint in the original Greek and the New Testament in the original Greek. That's the only way to study it.
Okay,
I don't want to hear any more about that.
What's the song?
I got to figure out how to send you the link.
Okay.
Because I can't. Okay, here we go. All right. Finally. Well, I guess I don't get a private chat anymore.
Yeah, it's there.
Let me see. Local video presentation setting. I'm up and down the screen looking for any indication.
I'll send you a message.
Of a chat. Of a
watch, it'll pop up.
I mean the studio restream chat.
Did it pop up?
It used to show up, but doesn't show up anymore.
Did it pop up?
It's not there. Yeah, it's so great. Okay, Fakeologist test.
Yeah.
Type a message. Now it's completely different. Can you see that?
Yep, I got it.
All right. They changed the format. Okay. I used to be able to get the chat window used to be on the side. But who knows? I don't care.
All right. We're going to start her up because it's time.
Viens par ici, veux-tu ma blonde? Là-bas, il y a trop de monde. Aujourd'hui je préfère les allées solitaires. Toi et moi, on sera bien mieux, je crois, dans ce tout petit sentier du bois où l'on ne voit personne. bien plus loin. Mignonne, il n'est pas besoin de faire constater par cent témoins comment tu t'abandonnes.
All right, good evening, everybody. It is Tuesday, June 11th, 2024. It's 8:08 p.m. Toronto time. This is the Fakeologist Show. Good evening, everyone. This is also the Lynn Hertel Show. She comes to our gracious shores every Tuesday to bring forth her wit, her wisdom, and she is on fire again tonight. We got all our technical issues swept to the side. I know people either love or hate the technical issues that are part of the pre-show. If you're listening to this in the video, you'll want to download the audio version of this because there is a pre-show where we were on. This is when we get acquainted and get going for about 5 or 10 minutes. So make sure you check that out. Go to fakeologist.blog to download the podcast or go to your favorite podcast player and just search for Fakeologist in the podcast index, in the Apple index, in the Podcast Addict index. There's so many indexes of podcasts, but just look up Fakeologist and you'll find two audio feeds, one for the audio chat, which has 1,424 different audios up to 20 hours long, or the Fakeologist FAK series, which we're almost up to show number 900. This is show 899. And this is where we talk about 9/11, JFK, COVIDs, where we believe that almost everything in the media is a fake, psyop, hoax, or some version thereof. We don't believe anything. And Lynn, welcome to the show. Why did you choose this audio tonight? Let me turn it down a sec. Hold on. I got to find what window it's in. Hold on a sec. Sorry. Let me just find it here. Oh, it's over anyway. Go ahead.
Well, that's from 1930. That recording.
Yeah.
And it's the most famous pop singer in France and the most famous French singer around the world in 1930. And probably for quite a few years after that, named Maurice Chevalier. I don't expect too many of your listeners to be familiar with him. Although
not me.
I was growing
up. Not me. I've never heard of him.
Right. If you'd ever seen the movie version of the Lerner and Lowe musical called Gigi, he stars in that with...
1933.
Louis Jourdan, Leslie Caron. You don't remember Leslie Caron? Quite beautiful. Starred in a number of movies. Very famous. These are French stars.
Okay.
Chevalier, hugely popular nightclub singer and recording artist. And when France capitulated to Germany in 1941. Most of the French they kind of surrendered.
Yeah.
And Chevalier, of course, his career, there were a number of French people who basically collaborated with the German occupation. In some cases, they went out of their way to do it.
Why is that?
Well, it's very complex.
It's not an easy story.
The Germans were the winners. I mean, they swept across France in about 6 weeks, which is insane when you think about it. It shows that the French they completely surrendered, and it shows their leadership completely surrendered, which suggests that most of the French general staff and French elites welcomed the Germans. They did. I that's the only way I can explain it. A country like France had a larger army. When you look at the logistics of it, the only thing they didn't have superiority over the Germans was Air Force. The Germans had the Luftwaffe. The French never really got their act together in terms of air power. But they had a huge army. They had modern tanks. In many cases, their weaponry and their army was more modern than that of Germany. The Germans were still using horses. Do a lot of their transport. A lot of people think, the Germans all had motorized transport. No, not then. But the French capitulated in six. Now, remember, there had been a phony war They called it the Sitzkrieg, which means sitting still war, for almost a year after the initial invasion of Poland and the declarations of war. And then all of a sudden, the Germans broke through and they just took over in 6 weeks. Now, so it might have been the speed and the ease with which the Germans just rolled right over France. But also, there may have been French who were, I don't know, perhaps sympathetic to the Germans in the beginning. The Germans pretty much wore out their welcome over time, though, because they ruled France very bad. They tried to loot it. You know, they plundered all the artwork and they plundered cash and they tried to use the French population as basically a slave labor force. So they, in the beginning, they might have been welcome, but they wore out their welcome pretty quick. Chevalier and another, of course, would have been Chanel, the great fashion legend, Coco Chanel. She was accused of being collaborating with the Germans as well. Now, after the war, a lot of people who were accused of being collaborators were treated very harshly. Some of them were lined up and shot. If they were informers, if they had informed to the SS about members of the resistance, they were lined up and shot. Women who dated German soldiers had their heads shaved. Prostitutes who consorted with German soldiers had their heads shaved. But for some reason or another, Chevalier, who everybody knew had been a favorite of German officers. I mean, Chevalier used to do command performances for the German general staff. So he was very popular among the Germans. And after the war, everybody knew he had collaborated. But they just kind of gave him a pass. They did. And he went on to an even more famous career, appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show three, four, half a dozen times. And appearing on American television and appearing in the movies. And as I say, you might remember his song from Gigi. He did a lot of songs, but his most famous was Thank Heaven for Little Girls. Are you familiar with that at all?
I've heard of it,
Thank heaven for little girls. For little girls get bigger every day. You never heard that?
Sure.
Okay. Why did you hear that? How do you happen to be familiar with that?
I don't know. It's just general knowledge. Should I play it?
Yeah, well, it's American musical theater. I know it's so, everybody thinks it's so gay, but it was not considered gay when I was growing up. Musicals were not considered gay, but I think they are now. Yeah, you can play a verse or two of that song. The opening is very typical of Chevalier.
It's called Thank Heaven for Little Girls.
Thank heavens for little girls. They grow up in the most delightful way. Without them, what would...
Maurice Chevalier.
Thank heaven for them all, no matter where, no matter who. Without them, what would little boys do? Yeah, unless your listeners are my age, they're not going to know this.
Someday, each and every one of them will either be married or unmarried. How adorable they are. Each time I see a little girl of 5 or 6 or 7, I can't resist a joyous urge to smile and say thank heaven for little girls.
Yeah.
For little girls get bigger every day. Thank heaven for little girls. They grow up in the most delightful way. Those little eyes so helpless and appealing, one day will flash and send you crashing through the ceiling.
Okay, very good. All right.
It's important to remember that he was singing for a generation that had grown up watching Shirley Temple movies in the 1930s. You got to put yourself in that mindset.
Nice.
Right? Innocence? Is it innocent? I don't know. You know, but why do I play that? Well, because I want to go back to this question of Dominique Strauss-Kahn.
Oh, right.
Now forgotten. Now forgotten. And we discussed him, what, last week or the week before, maybe?
Yeah.
And why was I taking note of him? Well, this guy was chairman of the International Monetary Fund. He was the most prominent member of the Socialist Party in France. Everyone was convinced he was going to succeed Sarkozy, who was the president.
And they just had dissolved their parliament, I think, in France.
Yeah, they're calling another election, I think. And we can get into that a little bit. But it's all theater.
It was on 14th of May, 2011, IMF Chairman Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Do you think this was a psyop or for realsies?
Well, you mean, did he really...
diddle the maid?
Assault the chambermaid in that expensive New York hotel? He was acquitted. Wasn't he acquitted of that?
Yeah, I think so, but they still dragged his name to
His career was ruined. Allegedly, his career was ruined because he subsequently had to resign from the IMF. He was no longer considered a viable candidate for president. He just disappeared. You don't hear about him now anymore.
You put this in Baller Skeptics Forum. Interesting.
Yeah, because that's where all the Freemasonry stuff is.
Oh, I see. Got it.
That's what's important about Dominique Strauss-Kahn. Not him as an individual. None of these world stage players matter or exist as individuals. They are functionaries of secret societies. And that's called synarchism or synarchy. Synarchy, rule by secret society.
Oh, synarchy. Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. And synarchism is the ideology of elite aristocrats who believe that they and their secret society should rule the world over us plebeians and peons. What I took note of, Dominique Strauss-Kahn, the biography officially says that he was born. Let me see what they actually say here.
Okay. I'll put this in the. Anyone who wants to follow along, I'll put it in the Fakeologist show notes here. And by the way, if you want to leave any kind of chat for Lynn, go to shortfake.com/chat. And you can leave a message. And I will read it if you want it. So anyone listening at shortfake.com/stream1, you can leave a chat.
Now, just to review, Dominique Strauss-Kahn was born in the wealthy Paris suburb of, I can't even pronounce it, on the Seine River. He is the son of Gilbert Strauss-Kahn, a lawyer who specialized in tax law and was a member of the Grand Orient Lodge of France. His mother was Jacqueline Felous, right? Strauss-Kahn's father was born to an Alsatian Jewish father. Alsace is in northern France on the border with Germany. So his father was Jewish, and a Catholic mother from Lorraine. However, Strauss-Kahn's mother is from a Sephardic Jewish family in Tunisia.
All right.
So that would mean in Jewish law, if your mother's Jewish, you're Jewish.
Right.
But I left a link to a genetic, you know, the whole family background of Dominique Strauss-Kahn. But as I was researching it, I came across a publication in New Jersey called New Jersey Lore, and I published a link to it in that post, where the author is discussing, and this is from a few years back, where the author is discussing all the scandals that have erupted in France, some of them involving human trafficking and other things, involving Freemasons. And she says, well, the lodges need to come clean and admit that this is going on, and so-and-so is involved. She mentions one particular, the Carlton scandal, which I know nothing about. Let me see what she says here. Her name is Coignard. Sophie Coignard covers the Mason beat at La Pointe magazine and wrote the book, A State Within a State. Most of the Masons I know are hyper-honest, says Coignard. But it's also fair to say that in most of the big financial political scandals of the past 20 years, you will find Freemasons, unquote. Coignard ticks off the Elf Aquitaine African bribery scandal, the Paris housing project scandal in the 1990s, and now something called the Carlton Affair, an ongoing investigation of a prostitution ring in Lille, France. Quote, They're mostly all Masons, says Coignard, of the Carlton's ringleaders. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, also embroiled in the affair, Carlton affair, is not a Mason. She has that in parentheses. Let me repeat that. They're mostly all Masons, says Coignard, of the Carlton's ringleaders. Carlton scandals ringleaders, his prostitution ring. Parentheses. Dominic Strauss-Kahn, also embroiled in the scandal, in the Carlton affair, is not a Mason, according to Sophie Coignard. Then she goes on to say that the solution is for French Masons to come out of the closet. It would help them clean house, and it would take the fun out of trying to peek through the closet keyhole. Now, I just indicated that Strauss-Kahn's father was actually financial advisor and lifelong member of the Grand Orient Lodge of France. But Sophie Coignard has obviously been instructed to tell us that Dominic Strauss-Kahn is not a Freemason, or at least she wrote that then. So this shows you how they are. That's a lie. It's got to be a lie. His family's been involved with the Grand Orient Lodge who knows how long. But we're supposed to believe that he's not a Freemason. So Freemasons lie. They lie their asses off. But this takes us into this question of what we mean by the cult of Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yeah, we know Yehuda, or Judah in King James English, was the largest tribe. He was one of Jacob's 11 sons, and ended up being the ancestor of the largest tribe called the Tribe of Yehuda. The Tribe of Yehuda was actually what King David came out of. That was his tribe. And so they became the original dynasty, the Davidic dynasty. And when the kingdom split following the death of Solomon, Yehuda and Benjamin, which is Judah and Benjamin, they formed the southern kingdom called Judah or Yehuda. And the other 10 tribes, which became the 10 lost tribes, which actually would probably be the 9 lost tribes, they moved north. They established their capital at Samaria, and their own temple, or their own holy place, on a mountain called Mount Gerizim, and that's where they had their altar. They didn't worship in Jerusalem. They didn't belong to the Jerusalem cult. They had a Jewish religion of their own, and they subsequently became what we call the Samaritans.
Mm-hmm.
But we're really talking about the cult of Yehuda in modern times, and it's obviously very critical. Yeah, Dominic Strauss-Kahn can't deny his Jewishness. In fact, he's proud of it. But somehow or other, why would he want to deny the fact that he's a Freemason when his family has been involved with the Grand Orient of Lodge for generations? Why would he want to deny that? Or why would Sophie Coignard, an official historian of American Freemasonry, why would she be so anxious, and French Freemasonry, why would she be so anxious to deny it? Because, you know, these people move in and among these secret societies, right? And in a sense, you know, is it ritualistic? Do they have to formally? It's like this business of, is there no help for the widow's son? They speak in code to each other. Anybody who's even familiar with the Freemasons and looks at the background of Dominic Strauss-Kahn would know right away that that's the environment he comes out of. And yet we're being told, no, not really. And this is what Jan Eric, I think, means by the cult of Yehuda.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the cult of Yehuda has now emerged in Mexico with the election of, their most recent president.
Oh, right, yeah.
Yeah, I posted a link to, here we go, the cult of Yehuda arises in Mexico.
Where did you post that link? Is it in the Fakeologist forums?
It's actually, yeah, it's in the forums. Exactly.
Okay, so I'll just type in Rise of Mexico here.
Yeah, arises in Mexico.
Oh, arises.
Arises in Mexico.
I can do a search. It's very fast, the Fakeologist forum search. Okay. Paging Jan Eric on the special role of the cult of Yehuda. Does this also often demand death faking and staged assassinations? Claudia Sheinbaum was born to Jewish parents, but she has played down her heritage on the campaign trail. Yeah, it wouldn't sell well in a Catholic country.
You'd think. What's important about Claudia Sheinbaum? She's a climate scientist. That's what we're being told.
Right.
That's her profession. She's a
They're the most important people in the world right now.
But we're also told that at least 24 political assassinations proliferated in the most recent Mexico.
I know. I really haven't looked into that at all. Does that sound reasonable to you?
Something like 27 assassinations, mostly of local political candidates.
It's amazing.
So are these real people to begin with?
Yes.
Or are they just corporate entities like Jesse Ventura, whose real name was James Janos?
Was he in the cult of Yehuda?
No, I don't think so. Well, not to... Janos is probably Eastern European Catholic, you know, Polish, Czech, Hungarian, possibly Hungarian. So now I kind of doubt that Jesse Ventura is Jewish, but you never know. I don't know. I don't think he'd conceal that if he was. But what I'm getting at here is when he was elected governor of Minnesota, which name was on the ballot? Jesse Ventura or James Janos? His wife's last name is Janos. His kids are all named Janos. Jesse Ventura is a corporate entity. At least Dominique Strauss-Kahn is using his real name. But as I say about all these alleged political assassinations in Mexico, how do we know any of them are even real? And what does it mean? What does it mean that we're being told this? That CNN is blasting this out.
Well, I think there is an organized campaign around the world to protect political people because they're starting to ramp up the idea that they're always under threat. So they need public money to create a security force for these people. And that implies that they're going to be doing things to their constituents in the next few years that are really going to require some form of protection. That's my take.
Yeah, if you scroll down that article here, there's a picture of one who was just assassinated. Is that right?
Well, this one here.
Blonde at the top.
Yeah, this one here.
A woman mayor in another city was assassinated almost, what, the same day as the election? Is that what we're being told?
Yeah, mayor of Cotija in Mexico's Michoacán state.
Michoacán. The reason why I know it's Michoacán is because back in the 60s, some of the best marijuana came from Michoacán.
Okay.
It was even called Michoacán. So.
Okay. Yeah, so yeah, maybe this is to create more security.
Well, this is their narrative.
Mm-hmm.
This is their narrative. What's the agenda behind the narrative? Well, you know, we can speculate on that. But this election of a member of the cult of Yehuda, Claudia Sheinbaum,
yeah,
whose claim to fame as a climate scientist, is very much bundled together with this narrative of massive political assassination in Mexico. So they're normalizing it. They really are normalizing it. And to me, it kind of reflects what Jan Erik is talking about, the manner in which members of the cult of Yehuda, either nominally or consciously, remember, a lot of Jews are not real swift. They're not real smart.
Okay.
People think they're smart because there are smart Jews running around, but not all of them are that smart. But I'll give you an example of how the cult of Yehuda operates. And this will perfectly confirm exactly what Jan Erik is talking about. Because he really put his finger on it here.
Wait. Is there a fake O2 video that I posted that is talking with Jan Erik?
It might have been one of the audio chats.
Well, it was in the audio chat. Maybe I pulled it out of there. And so people know what I'm talking about.
You should bring him back to elaborate on it, because I wanted to look at some of the material that I'm posting.
Well, here's one from a month ago. Let's play a bit of this.
That thing you just said, how do you know that?
Because I've done my fucking research, that's why, John.
Like, where'd you get the information?
Oh, that's John LeBond. That's the one.
Yeah, this was FAC 1411.
Yeah, John LeBond tries to kind of...
Well, he wants evidence.
Cut him down to size, but yeah, and Eric handles it. I love the way he handled this.
How was the research? You should try it. Find the
can you give an example of where you got the information?
I'm glad you're asking this question, John. I really am. That's good. Yeah. Yeah, please.
There are plenty of sources.
I know.
Can you give me one?
You could try searching the fucking internet. It's
I'm
easy.
I'm asking you, though. Because you're the one saying this. I'm just asking you.
The Jews were living inside the fucking cities of the merchant nobility. It's easy. They were not living outside the city walls of these cities. It's easy.
Wait, when was this, though? When was
this?
Recently.
When?
Up until the early 1800s. Then it changed.
Okay, how do we know that? Like, is that in a book or something? Can I read it, like, in a book? Is that where that's from?
No, I know. So it was this way in Norway as well. It was in the constitution of Norway that you couldn't have Jews in Norway, but the merchant cities in Norway, the Jews were allowed because it's not considered Norwegian territory, so the Norwegian constitution didn't apply there.
Yeah,
so if I look into the Norwegian constitution, I'm going to find it.
Yeah, say that again, Lynn.
Jews constituted a special exception in every situation as a social class. The first effort to actually integrate them into a society as citizens was Napoleon Bonaparte in the French Republic. Well, when he became dictator, he ultimately became emperor of France. But the Napoleonic Code is the first place you really have a European nation attempting to convert Jews into citizens of a republic, the French Republic. And then subsequently, at least a generation or two later, the Germans got around to it as well. But, and it's very problematic that, because then the question of dual loyalty arose. And in the end, I think Bonaparte, while he was sympathetic to the Jews in the beginning, he turned against them. He really did. And there are a whole range of explanations why. Probably had to do with the Rothschild banking interests and other who were attempting to sabotage Bonaparte's military camp, whatever, you know, his credit and his currency, you know, the Jews in the British Empire kind of ganged up on Bonaparte, but he really thought that the Jews could be assimilated into France as citizens, and they would give up their Jewishness and just become Frenchmen, like all the other Frenchmen. But it didn't work out that way. Go ahead, let Jan Eric finish on this.
Okay, well, it's 12 minutes. I don't know if we want to...
Well, okay. I can summarize what he gets at, because...
Yeah, go for it.
Well, he's going all the way back to the Middle Ages in the creation of merchant cities. And he mentions the Hanseatic League, which was a very powerful coalition of German merchant cities. Independent free cities. I think Danzig may have been one of these cities. Now it's called Gdansk.
Right. So Danzig was a merchant city? Yeah.
Right. And you had, of course, the Venetians, the Italian city-states had a merchant class of their own, banking and merchants. The Medici, for one. The Medici were very famous as bankers and merchants.
Mm-hmm.
So the Jews weren't the only ones. But what Jan Eric is pointing to is the special position of the Jews as people who existed in the margins between empires and usually knew both languages. In the ancient world, Jews typically knew both Greek and Aramaic. Aramaic, which was the lingua franca of the Parthian or Persian Empire, which was constantly in a state of war or competition with Rome. Parthians or Persians, they were the only other large empire on the horizon during most of the existence of Rome. And since Parthia had a large and influential Jewish population, it created a problem for the Roman emperors because it raised the possibility that Jews couldn't entirely be trusted. That in a conflict between Parthia and Rome, if the Parthians offered the Jews their independent state, in Roman-occupied Palestine, the Jews might betray the Romans. It's very complicated.
Yeah, so is the Hanseatic League, was a medieval commercial and defensive network of merchant guilds and market towns in Central and Northern Europe. So this is a lot of history here. People need to understand.
Right. You're really talking about
this is before
the
countries.
Rise of capitalism here.
Is this before countries, really, in a way?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Very medieval. Right. You don't really have what we consider modern nation states emerging to about the 16th, 17th century. And they're not officially recognized until the Treaty of Westphalia, which was signed at the end of the 30 Years' War, which is like 1640 something. Devastating conflict. It's just areas of Europe never recovered. The great city of Magdeburg in Germany was just utterly destroyed during this conflict. And the Peace of Westphalia essentially said that nations in Europe had to mutually respect each other's boundaries, and they had to mutually respect the state religion of each of these independent states. So this was particularly critical in Germany, where some states, such as Prussia or maybe Hesse or Saxony, chose to become Lutheran and Protestant, whereas other states, like, say, Bavaria, remain Catholic. See? So the way the Germans resolved this, they said, well, if you lived in a duchy or principality where the official religion was Protestantism, then that was your religion. If you lived in one that was Catholic, that was your religion. This was really the solution of the Swiss cantons going all the way back to the 14th century. But it took Europeans 300 years of either papal domination if you think about religious conflict between the Protestant Reformation and the Catholic Church, Luther nails up his 95 thesis on the church door at Wittenberg in like 1519.
Mm-hmm.
And then the conflict starts to break out. And like I say, it lasts over 100 years. So at the same time, you have these independent merchant cities that are trying to preserve their independence. And they basically lost it in the end to the nation states, which were consolidated around monarchies. And the Jews played a critical role in this, because in order for a nation to be united around a central government, a king especially, a dynasty, you know, it needed financial support and mercantile support. It needed a stable currency. This goes all the way back to William the Conqueror and the Battle of Hastings and the Norman conquest of England. He brought over a whole troop of Jewish bankers to help him set up new monetary arrangements and taxation policies in his kingdom, his newly acquired kingdom of England.
Mm-hmm.
Because really, as the Duke of Normandy, to be the Duke of Normandy was much more important than to be the King of England. To be the Duke of Normandy or the Duke of Aquitaine or the Counts of Anjou in France, much more important than to be King of England. England was kind of a backwater for a long time. And like I say, the Plantagenets, who were a French-speaking dynasty descended from Vikings, who married into the descendants of Charlemagne to establish the Plantagenet dynasty. And they had a rather ambivalent relationship with the Jews. Initially, as I say, Henry II, the founder of the dynasty in England, he brought Jews over to help him with finances. But then when he was succeeded by his son, Richard Coeur de Lion, Richard the Lionhearted, at that point the Jews were like expelled from England. So, you know, back and forth. If a king became indebted to financiers, at some point he could say, well, usury is not Christian. It's prohibited by Christian law.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seizing all your assets and kicking your asses out of here. And that could happen. It did happen.
So it was kind of a double-edged sword for the
For the merchants. They were brought in as tax farmers and rent collectors. And this is what Jan Erik means by the Jews were there to mediate. Mm-hmm. They were there to be the collectors, the rent collectors, the tax collectors. And when you think about the emergence of media in modern times, well, there you go. You see the presence of Jews in newspapers and publishing. And
so that is what media means. Mediate. Mediators. Mediate, they're the go-betweens.
Go-betweens, exactly. And so Jan Erik has really nailed this, I think.
So that's why they get all the flack, because they're busy doing the mediating. So instead of blaming the other side, you blame the guy in the middle who's passing on the messages.
Right. It's a designated role. And once again, we're into the, you know, it's a dirty job, but someone's got to do it.
Yeah.
One particular instance that's really striking, and Jews remember this, especially Hasidic Jews. In the mid to late 17th century, Poland, the Poles had an empire that included Lithuania, the Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, Estonia, and Ukraine.
Okay.
Of course, ultimately they lost that to the Russians, but because Poland was a Catholic country.
Yeah.
But the Ukrainians, they were Eastern Orthodox. They followed the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. You know, you can tell the difference between a Roman Catholic and someone who is a member of one of the Eastern Orthodox churches is when a Roman Catholic crosses himself, right? He goes from, he does the vertical line from forehead to belly, and then he goes from left to right to come across to make the sign of the cross. He goes from left, they make that sign from left to right, whereas Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Serbian Orthodox, Ukrainian Orthodox, they make the sign of the cross from right to left.
Oh, brother.
Now, there is also a branch of the Roman Catholic Church in Ukraine. It's small, and they form the sign of the cross in the traditional Catholic way from left to right. That's just a, kind of a superficial comparison of the two. But this antagonism between the authority of the Church of Rome and the Pope and the Eastern Orthodox Christians, it was one of the aggravating factors in the situation in Ukraine. Because the Polish nobility really oppressed Ukrainian peasants and taxed the hell out of them and oppressed them and brutalized them. And ultimately, it led to a massive revolt by the Cossacks, the Ukrainians.
Mm-hmm.
There's a nice movie that was made about this starring Yul Brynner and Tony Curtis called Taras Bulba. Taras Bulba is a legendary Ukrainian hero who led this uprising against the Poles. And
they'd never be able to make a movie like that today.
Yeah, spectacular, really. Now, the role of the Jews in this was really critical because
1962. You really know how these are your epic movies, aren't they?
Oh, I could go. Listen, I ought to do a separate show on movies. I really
should. Old movies.
This shows the Siege of Dubno.
No.
The Ukrainians,
the
late siege
of Dubno. To the wonders of the world.
This was a spectacular film.
Harold Hex, Taras Bulba.
They don't make them like this anymore.
No.
Not with digital, and real horses.
1,000 horsemen thundering across the giant theater screen.
Talk about a cast of thousands.
The stunning impact of the Cossack horde, sweeping across the wild, primitive steppes of the Ukraine, shouting the terrifying Cossack battle cry.
Was this a movie for Americans? Did they actually buy into this stuff?
Oh, yes. Are you kidding? In the 60s? Oh, yes. They competed with each other in making huge, expensive, spectacular productions, really. And what's important about this revolt that they show here is that these Cossacks went around hanging Polish nobles, and right alongside of those Polish nobles, they hanged their Jewish tax and rent collectors. So the Ukrainian uprising of the mid-17th century really came down hard on the Jews because they have been functioning as middlemen for the Polish nobility in collecting these oppressive taxes and rents from the Ukrainian farmers and peasants who rose up in revolt.
Mm-hmm.
Khmelnytsky, I think, was the most famous of these revolts, leaders of the revolt. And once again, it's the manner in which the Jews got caught in the middle. Because they were doing the dirty work you know, the dirty work of handling, you know, collecting the rent and coming to kick you off, evict you off your land if you didn't pay the Polish noble who owned your land.
Well, they filmed it in Argentina.
Yeah, well, that was probably the cheapest place to find horse riders. But
oh, is that right? Yeah,
Ukraine,
that's interesting.
Ukraine was still part of the Soviet Union back then. The Russians, by the way, the Soviet Union probably made several movies about Taras Bulba. I mean, he's famous over there. Americans wouldn't know who he was, but if you say he was Taras Bulba in Russia, they all know who he was. In Ukraine, you know, he's a national hero.
Interesting.
So, yeah, just to clarify, we're showing the role that the cult of Yehuda plays as handling the cash, handling the banking, handling the usury, doing the dirty work of collecting the rent and collecting the taxes, and probably serving eviction notices on the peasants who get kicked out of their homes or off their land.
The film was budgeted at $3.8 million, but it went $2.2 million over. After poor sales at the box office, it ended up costing United Artists about $4.5 million. It did not work.
No.
It did not work in America. They're not. They don't care about history.
It would have worked in Europe.
Yeah.
Because in Europe, people like historical epics. But let me tell you, a film that failed in America, failed miserably in America, was a huge hit in Europe. It's very long. And I still go back and watch it because it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's Stanley Kubrick's greatest masterpiece on the screen. And you never heard of it, I'll bet.
Go ahead.
Well, it stars Ryan O'Neill, and it's called Barry Lyndon.
I did watch it. I didn't get it. I didn't understand. It was...
Well, you have to, I guess...
I watched it. I couldn't understand it.
It's a faith... What do you mean? He's caught up in the events of his time.
It was so boring. Oh, my
goodness. He marches off to war.
I couldn't stand it. Okay. I know I tried to watch it. I don't know if you recommended it, but yeah.
Well, maybe you think it was too slow-moving.
Yeah. Oh, slow-moving.
It's Stanley Kubrick. He was writing from the novel.
I know.
These guys are bringing famous novels.
I'm obviously not a big fan of Stanley Kubrick, honestly. I tried, yeah. That's when I was watching all his movies. I rented all the movies on Netflix when you used to get the DVDs in the mail. I remember that now.
Well, you know, obviously Barry Lyndon was a failure in America, but now it's become a cult classic. People go back and they watch it and they appreciate it. When's the last time you watched it again?
I only tried to watch it once. I'm never trying again.
You're not much of a reader of
no
Thomas Hardy's not, or who wrote Barry Lyndon? Not Thomas Hardy. Who wrote it? Did they say who wrote the novel, the original novel?
It said in the United States it earned $9 million. Ultimately, it grossed $31 million worldwide.
Well, you know, based on a famous novel, you know, like Martin Scorsese made a film. I think it was brilliant. You probably hated it, too. Called The Age of Innocence.
Okay.
You see, you're just not into movies as representations of novels.
No, I probably not.
Because you wouldn't be reading novels anyway, would you?
No.
Right.
I'm a simpleton.
When it comes to this stuff, I think so, yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Your idea of movies is light entertainment.
No, I'm not a big movie watcher. I'm not, just not my thing.
I have a whole thread.
But I am trying to watch some of the movies you recommend.
Right, and you also want to avoid the ones that I'm telling you to stay away from.
I will.
I have a whole thread on Ridley Scott's absolute disaster. Utter fiasco on Napoleon Bonaparte. And so many films have been made about Napoleon. I mean, the French have made, who knows, probably 20 or 30. A number have been made here in the United States. The British have made some. And you would have expected more from Ridley Scott. If you want to go to the forum and read some of my reviews, because, you know, I probably put it there under the subject of historical revisionism, because we are discussing...
Yeah, we better get back to some fakeology here.
Right. We don't want to get into movie reviews at this point, I guess.
No. So you really... This all started with the cult of Yehuda arises in Mexico, and this is all under the warfare in the movies, the suicide charge forum heading.
That's about the movies.
Well, that's where this... Cult of Yuda arises in Mexico. You put it under that form. Is that where you wanted it? Under medieval warfare?
That's not where I put it.
That's where it is.
I don't know how it ended up there because
I was replying.
I don't understand that because I was replying to something having to do with cults.
Well, that's where it ended up. So that's where I found it.
Right.
You want it somewhere else?
No, that's where it belongs, about cults.
It's under revisionism.
Right. Okay. Right. Mm-hmm. And it is revisionism. I have some remarks on medieval warfare and Shakespearean theater. Because, you know, we're talking about historical, you know, if we're going to get into historical revisionism here, there's some real problems with some of the sources of what we think constitute accurate historical records. So, for example, I was watching this isn't about the Cult of Yehuda, unless you want to consider Shakespeare to be part of the Cult of Yehuda as well. And for that, you got to bring Joe Atwill back.
Well.
Well, because he attributes Shakespeare's work to a Jewish poetess from Italy named Emilio Bassano. And he makes a very strong case for it. How her family was brought over covertly during the reign of Elizabeth. And he credits her with having authored most of the material that is attributed to William Shakespeare. So we see the Cult of Yehuda showing up in literature, in poetry, in drama. And I make reference to the fact that one of the lesser known plays of Shakespeare, attributed to Shakespeare, because a lot of people think Shakespeare was actually Sir Francis Bacon, a contemporary. A stronger case, I think, is made by British scholar Nick Kallerstrom, that in fact, most of Shakespeare's work was written by the Earl of Oxford, Edward de Vere, who came from a Catholic family, which is very problematic in Elizabethan England. So he attributes it to de Vere, and he makes the case. Some think that Marlowe was involved, or that Shakespeare was a committee, an editorial committee. But Joe Atwill makes a very strong case that at least the sonnets, which is the bulk of Shakespeare's poetry, were written by a Jew, and in particular, a Jewish woman named Emilio Bassano. And I think he makes a strong case for it. In this play by Shakespeare called The Life and Death of King John, it's considered one of his historical plays. There are many, many references repeatedly to canon. Makes no sense at all. Let me share this the screen here. If I can get this screen sharing here. Or wait a minute. Screen sharing. Where is it? It must be at the bottom.
Yeah, I think your bottom is cut off.
Well, I don't know. I've got type a message at the very bottom. Let's see. Okay, here we go. Extra camera. Share screen. Got it. Very good. Very good.
All right, we got about 10 minutes left, so let's make sure you get all your points.
I'm getting, why is Shakespeare in a play about the 13th century? The Magna Carta was signed in 1215 at the very end of the reign of King John, who Shakespeare wrote this play about. John was the brother of Richard Lionheart. John Lackland, he was called, and his really failed reign, a failed monarchy. It was a disaster for England, but it led to the Magna Carta, which is very famous. And Shakespeare, let's see if I can, I just can't get to this button. That's too bad.
There it is. You got it.
So here are all the lines. I went and I watched a performance of this play, The Life and Death of King John. And over again, they refer to canon. The thunder of my cannon shall be heard. Well then, to work, our cannon shall be bent. They'll hear the thunder. It just goes on and on. There's all these references to canon. Like a half a dozen references to canon in this play. Excuse me, but primitive rudimentary firearms and cannon did not exist until the late 1300s at the earliest. And King John, John Plantagenet, his reign ended around 1215, 1216.
Wow.
There were no muskets, no cannon, nothing like that. Gunpowder didn't exist in Europe at that time. What was Shakespeare thinking when he wrote this? And what was his audience thinking when they're watching a play about one of their own kings from at least 300 years earlier? And Shakespeare is saying, oh, they're talking about cannon. Wouldn't anyone in the audience have been bothered by that? It just doesn't make any sense, does it?
No.
Yeah, cannon did not exist in medieval warfare until very, very late in the Middle Ages. Very late. Almost about 1400. By about 1400, you start to see them. But even then, they weren't really perfected until like the 1490s. So, you know, it's ridiculous. And you would have thought that Shakespeare's audience would have laughed the play off the stage. But I don't get it. Why is, you know... This is the kind of thing you find. If you saw this in an American movie, and you see this crap all the time in American movies, where they'll show something that's completely out of place.
Yeah.
You know, it's out of place and out of time. And I'm just pointing out, here's Shakespeare doing it. Why is he doing this? And what does it mean? And would his audience have even cared about it? You know, because many of Shakespeare's plays deal with medieval warfare. His Henry V shows the Battle of Agincourt, which is really the most famous battle to Shakespeare's generations, this glorious victory in France won by Henry V. You know, that's the one where he says, we band of brothers upon St. Crispin's Day, that famous line. Olivier's done it. Kenneth Branagh has done it. Henry V. Shakespeare's audience was not ignorant or stupid. Surely they would have known the canon didn't exist during the reign of King John, and yet he's got them in the play. It really bothers me. It bothers me. What's it doing there? So, you know, something else where it doesn't exactly fall within the realm of fakeology, but it poses the question of how can a history play be so wrong? How could something purporting to be an accurate account of a historical event that should have been familiar to all Englishmen? They all knew the story of King John because they all knew what the Magna Carta was. And they knew that cannon and rifles and muskets certainly didn't exist. They didn't exist. Crossbows did. The English actually, the weapon of preference for the English was the English longbow. Which it was even better than.
So what's the bottom line? We're saying this is fake history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's. I would you call it an anachronism or an incongruity? It mm-hmm. doesn't make any sense. If you were watching a film about knights, and then one of these knights pulled his six gun and shot the other knight, what would you think?
Yeah, there's that. There's definitely a movie error.
I know people that will sit through this and it wouldn't bother them at all because they're so ignorant of actual history that they wouldn't know the difference, would they?
Yeah.
So that's a fake audience in my view.
Yeah.
It's an ignorant audience. So other things.
All right. We got about 5 minutes. Do you want to,
go through, you know, actually if I go through the forums here, get to something recent, because what I pretty much do is go back to everything I've got. I've been covered so much ground over the last week. A lot of revisionist history here. Of course, I've got a whole discussion of Napoleon Bonaparte and the role of the individual in history.
Mm-hmm.
The Challenger hoax. Oh, yes.
Oh, Simon! Simon chimed in on that because he says, "Why hasn't this guy given me credit?" Because he's saying he was the one that at least did the picture.
Of the Challenger explosion?
Yeah, he's the one that pointed out the that these guys were still alive. Hold on, we got a caller in here. Wait,
you got stuff all Hold over the time. Web about that
one
now.
1 minute, 19 seconds.
Hello, caller in here. Where are you calling from?
Hey, how's it going? This is Tony the Slow Adult from Los Angeles.
Hey, Tony. Sorry I missed your call earlier. I don't know what happened.
My God, you live in L.A. itself?
Yeah, man. I wanted to chime in today because Lynn's in, and I really wanted to say something to her.
All right. And I think you put a donation through. I think it came through.
Did you get it? Good.
I think so. Thank you so much.
Yeah, I'll send more.
Stories about L.A. Are they exaggerated?
Keep working. I'll keep sending money.
All right, we're working every week.
So can Lynn hear me or no?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Oh, hey, Lynn. Man, I really, really love your point of view and your research, and you're just such a great guest. And, hey, fakeologist, is your first name Tim? How can
yeah.
I call you?
Yeah, you call me okay. Tim.
All right, man. Thank you for putting out a type of forum where someone like Lynn can have a voice, and what you're doing is just awesome.
Thank you,
it.
Tony. I think you're the fast adult now.
Yeah, I mean, this guy has 11 ways to send him a donation, and I can't figure it out. I'm like,
yeah, it's
PayPal,
all right.
PayPal, how do I pay? So, first question, a dumb question for Lynn is, I've never seen her, and just hearing her voice makes me think of that comedian Fortune Feimster. Does Lynn look like Fortune Feimster? Just curious.
Say it again.
Who's Fortune Feimster?
Never heard.
She's a comedian. When I hear Lynn's voice, I think of Fortune Feimster. And
I gotta look it up.
I never heard of her.
What does Lynn look like?
Lynn, what do you look like? Lynn has been
attacks on the truth. These attempts.
Lynn has been in. Lynn has been on a video before.
Yeah, let me screen. I got my camera off.
Oh, here we go. Lynn is. You're showing a picture of the ceiling right now.
Well, you know, there are some videos of me out there on the mat losing. I might have one out there.
Lynn is a jiu-jitsu artist.
Yeah, but here,
no kidding.
If I can get my camera. Got my camera on. Wait, you should see what I look like at least so you know I'm real. How do I get the
Lynn,
camera?
Let me ask you a real question, Lynn. What do you think of those old world buildings that have amazing architecture, like the post offices and government buildings? And they're all supposedly built in the 1800s in 2 or 3 years, and they all burnt down and some remain, but what do you think about that ancient architecture stuff?
Well, you know, a lot of those buildings were built during the Great Depression. And a lot of the highway work was done during the Great Depression as well under the Works Progress Administration. But you're right. If you look at some of the spectacular buildings, if you see state capitals, for example, and 19th century office buildings, they are amazing.
Yeah.
It makes me think of the problem that existed following the crisis of the 3rd century in the Roman Empire. By the time Diocletian resolved a century of civil war and instability, and then he was succeeded by Constantine the Great. Constantine the Great established an eastern capital at what was called Byzantium, and it became Constantinople. Naturally, he wanted to build churches, cathedrals, I guess, because he had converted to Christianity, and statues and amphitheater, all the things that Romans build when they create a new city for his city of Constantinople. And the Roman historians recount the fact that by this time, there were no more decent sculptors left anywhere in the empire. And what Constantine had to resort to was plundering and looting the stone and the monuments from all around the empire and bringing these old artifacts to his new city to become the statuary in his eastern capital. Now, there was new architecture that was done. Certainly Hagia Sophia, which you can see today in Istanbul,
Yeah.
Actually, pretty much built by Justinian the Great, and then improved upon later. But what you can see in the case of Rome was that over time, what had been commonplace skills and crafts throughout the empire, after a century of conflict and stagnation, they just disappeared. And by the end of the Roman Empire, no one knew how a lot of these fantastic sculptures had been created.
And
architecture declined. You know, that's what I think we're experiencing in the late 20th century.
And I
don't think there's any ancient mystery to it. It's decline and fall of the empire is what it is.
Okay, but look at the buildings in the New World in North America. They're
you're not a mud flood person, are you? You think these buildings are buried like 3 feet?
I don't know. I mean, I'm not one of those, but I'm just wondering. Like, it seems possible that there was a more advanced culture that built those things, and that culture then went away.
But we have records of the built, like state capitol buildings, for example.
There are? Okay, that would be a key piece, because I didn't think there were.
Right, like for example, you ever seen a state capitol building in Charleston, West Virginia? Oh, it's got a dome. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah, right.
Same with the capitol building in Winnipeg. We were talking about that years ago with Frank, somebody, about the Freemasonry architecture.
The question is,
how did they build that in 1800,
right, when they didn't have motorized transport? Everything would have had to been hauled by horses.
No power, no power tools, right?
Right.
It's just all.
Well, it took a lot longer.
But that's the mystery. All the stonework was done by hand.
Yeah. Hey, Lynn, we're getting close on we're a little over time. Did you want to talk about the Challenger?
Well, only to say that it's breaking into the mainstream now, and I think we're riding a wave on this.
Oh, okay. Tony, you don't mind. We're going to talk about the Challenger thing before we wrap up.
I want to hear it. I love that. I love that topic. Let's hear it.
Yeah, it's on the screen here.
Yeah, let me bring back that.
This guy here. This is
Stupeters. Stupiders. This guy here. Yeah.
I come here asking for your help, but first a little backstory. I think we all remember the Challenger explosion that took place in 1986 that tragically took the lives of all 7 astronauts on board. It launched not too far from where we're standing here today. Well, the interesting thing is,
this guy went to Brevard County, which is where Cape Canaveral is. And he went in front of the county commissioners, and they basically blew him out the door. This was a couple of weeks ago.
Even though NASA's probably the largest employer in that. Well, NASA, is Disney in Brevard County? Disney's in Orlando, right?
Yeah,
but
Disney's
probably NASA's
Orlando.
Largest employer, and maybe even the largest taxpayer in Brevard County, I'll bet.
Yeah.
Now, Simon, there's a couple interesting people. Number one, Xylophilex says this is a PSYOP.
What's a PSYOP? Exposing the Challenger?
No, I don't quite. I got to get Xylophilex back on here, because every time I put this post up, he complains that this woman here, Judith Resnick, is not the same person as this person.
She's a ringer. She's a ringer. Come on. She looks exactly like her.
Well, no, but they say the Challenger, Judith Resnick, doesn't look like
Judith.
This one. I don't know. I'm confused by this argument. They look pretty similar to me, but
they look very similar.
So I didn't quite understand this, but he was going back to the Veterans Today article. So if you can figure out what Xylophilex is talking about, and what Kaham is talking about,
there might be a flaw in our evidence. That our evidence.
Yeah, he's saying the fact that they don't look the same is trying to expose us for being.
Yeah, but when you look at some of the others, like look at some of the others. Carl McNair, the black guy, the African American guy. Look at the Asian American character in this. Krista McAuliffe, the school teacher. She was supposed to be the star of that Challenger expedition. Look, This thing is, it's out of the bag. It's hit the mainstream, right? It's hit the mainstream. People are seeing it now. I think it's an Achilles heel. I think it's going to blow things wide open. I don't think people are going to just let this slide because it's a real, they should have made these people disappear. They should have given them new names and new identities, but they didn't do that. They let them keep their same names. It's crazy. Yeah. That's how arrogant they are.
Hey, Lynn.
Yeah.
Lynn, could this be a trauma ritual? Because they got all the kids watching it on live TV. It was a big deal. Everybody had a TV rolled into their classroom to watch the event.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was a huge trauma for kids.
Oh, you remember Channel 1? You remember the dispute over Channel 1? That was the year when, for the first time in American history, and I think it was Microsoft that started doing it, they were attributing free televisions to every school and every classroom. That whole year ahead of the Challenger event, they were moving televisions into the classroom. We all saw this happening. And people were very disturbed about it. They said, we don't want to bring television into the school classroom. That's not where it belongs.
Right.
And
right.
They said, oh, no, we're going to have special programs for the kids. And they created a special news program for junior high school kids and high school kids. And basically, the whole Channel 1 business was to get televisions into the classroom so that when this Challenger event rolled around, everybody would be watching. And they were watching. I was working at that time for Bell Atlantic, which subsequently became Verizon. They had a huge office complex in Burtonsville, Maryland. And I was on my way from the cafeteria back upstairs. And there were, you know, we had television screens in the hallways. And everybody was gathered around. Everybody was watching this. You're right. They programmed it so everybody in America would be watching.
Yeah. It's like, it was like where were you when JFK got shot kind of thing for like
Like JFK, 9/11. Yep.
Yeah.
And it reaffirms what Richard Nixon observed, that the American people don't believe anything until they see it on television. They see it on television, then it's real.
Right.
I don't know why.
I'm
looking at the Clues Forum right now. It's having its best day ever today. So I don't know what the hell's going on over there. Something is happening because Simon was asking, why is this Challenger thing coming up now? And I guess it's mainly why. So she's wondering if this Justin Roberts guy is there something else happening here? Because it's now.
You know, it's true that sometimes one of the ways you weaken the impact, if you know you're going to take a punch.
Yes, you steer the river.
Right.
You can't stop the river. All you can do is steer it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Can you contain it? If you can't contain it, can you divert it?
Yeah. So here we go here. Let me just see here. So Simon is asking here, as many of you probably have noticed, my old 2015 investigation into the astronauts who allegedly perished in the infamous Challenger disaster has gone completely, absolutely viral over the internets. Yes, the Challenger astronauts are most likely alive and well, and we should all be happy about it since no lives were lost on that day. This little Clues Forum thread has now reached 1.5 million views. But just imagine how many more people have now heard of this lame NASA hoax all around the world. However, as much as I rejoice over the fact that this little research of mine has now reached many millions of people, I have to wonder why it is now being heavily promoted, needless to say perhaps, without any mention or due credit of my painstaking investigation by some sensationalist truther channels such as that of Stu Peters, who clearly appears to be posturing to become the new Alex Jones of our times. I think he's right about that.
Well, he is dressing like a disco John Travolta these days with the third button down and the gold chain. Like, what are you doing, brother, man? I mean, credit. I mean, what is it? Who is this guy? Is looking a little bit like he's taking some money now or something. I don't know, man. I like his message, but he's turning into like a caricature. I mean, he's slicking his hair back. He's looking like a gigolo. I'm like, what? You know, I thought he was, I don't know, man.
Well, it's just, Stu Peters is riding the trend. He sees it's the trend. Yeah. He sees where it's going, and he wants to ride this horse.
Well, so, here it is here. Here's the picture that Simon put on Clues Forum. But again, no credit to Clues Forum at all. So I'm curious, maybe now someone's linked to it.
I remember seeing people on the web pointing out these resemblances between the alleged martyrs of the Challenger disaster.
When did that start, though? Did that start in 2015 with Simon, which is 9 years ago?
It's been around for a while.
But how long? Simon did this in 2015. This is Simon's image here. He put this.
Well, that's one of the images that I remember looking at.
Right. And in the image that Simon showed, they cut out the Clues Forum thing off the bottom. Do you see that? So this is what this is from Stupid Peters'
show.
That
looks like a copyright violation to me.
And if you click on it.
So they're not giving Clues Forum credit for that particular image composite?
No, because here's the picture that Simon put on. Simon put on the URL and his name on the bottom, you see?
And they took that off.
They clipped it off. They cut off the bottom. So.
Oh, wow.
So that's pretty good.
Yeah, so they're stealing his work. They're stealing his work. Here's Krista McAuliffe at the bottom. She was supposed to be the school teacher. She was the most famous passenger on it.
Yeah, because his name? Zylflex is arguing that this Resnick is not the same. I don't know what he's arguing.
I don't either. They look like they could easily be the same. But the other ones are like McNair. Is it McNair? He's the African-American guy. Yeah, right there. Carl.
Then Ronald.
Ronald McNair, right.
Yeah, Ronald McDonald, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the other one, the Asian-American guy.
The Japanese guy, Ellison Onozuka.
Right, and by the way, they're all claiming that they're twin brothers.
Right.
That's the other thing that speaker at the Brevard County meeting, county council meeting.
Yes, it was great.
He said that the statistical likelihood of these people all having twin brothers or twin sisters is ridiculous. There's no way that could be. I mean, what are you telling me? They're cloning astronauts, right? They're deliberately breeding them? No, I don't think so. But, okay, I understand where Simon's coming from on this. He feels like his work has been appropriated. He hasn't been given credit for it. So that's probably true.
But it seems like maybe someone put a link to Clues for him. Because today he was complaining about this a couple of days ago. And now Stupid Peters is promoting it. Stupid Peters has 33,000 views on his video here.
Well, it's a trending. The whole thing is he wants to jump on that trend. It's clickbait for him, but for us, it's real. For us, it's a real issue. For us, it's something worth looking at and worth explaining to people, because you can never overestimate the impact that Challenger disaster for a whole generation.
Okay, here's somebody. Somebody actually linked to it here.
Okay.
Okay, that's good news. So there you go, Simon. I should make a note to Simon that someone linked to the Clues Forum. So that's good.
Jim,
go ahead.
Hey, in all the years that we've allegedly been going to space and all the money we've spent exploring space and having a space station and having rockets and everything, name one thing that we as a species have learned or gained from doing any science in space or any space travel or any NASA money spent. Name one thing that's benefited the people that paid for it.
Well, they say Velcro.
Velcro. And Tang, the breakfast drink.
I know, that's funny.
Which is mostly sugar.
The whole purpose of the NASA fraud is to get people into science, technology, and math. It's really just to get people into doing research. And people into math and whatnot, as far as I know.
Worldview, too. It's a religion.
Yeah. NASA Mystery Babylon is what William Cooper called it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Mystery Babylon.
Mystery Babylon,
Babylon,
yeah.
Stuff, right.
So it looks like maybe that's why Clues Farm is having such a good day.
Well, I'm going to start posting a link to that Clues Forum page whenever NASA comes up now that I know that's, there's so many great things we have to use, but that Challenger thing, the emotional impact on people, and it was clearly designed to revive, their interest in the space program was dead. I remember that in the mid 80s. No one gave a damn about it. They had lost interest. No one was paying attention to it. And so clearly this Challenger disaster event was designed to reawaken interest in the space program.
Absolutely.
Otherwise, maybe Congress was thinking of cutting their budget.
Oh, totally. Yeah, totally correct.
Totally. All the money.
And that's all the more reason why we got to use it. Because we got a whole audience out there, probably of Gen Z maybe, or millennials. Watched that and they were shocked by it.
Yeah, music, baby. Let's go.
Well, that's the closeout. There's a picture of Lynn if you want to go wave to Lynn on the screen. And there's me above Lynn there, that little wizard. That's me, so that's as much as you're going to get out of me. So I got a face for radio, so I'm going to keep it that way, Tony. Hey, Tony, thanks for the donations. Yeah. And thanks for calling, man.
Yeah, Tony, sure. Thanks for calling in. And keep us posted on L.A. Hey, we want to hear about what's going on in L.A., so don't hesitate to call in and let us know, because L.A. sounds kind of like a combat zone to me.
Yeah. Lynn, everybody loves the girl from Baltimore, let me tell you.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that.
Well, I figured Lynn was a great caller in her on so many shows, so she should probably have her own show. So
hell yeah, she's the best.
Well, she's got a lot of fans, so maybe you're the original fan that was telling me to get her on all the time. I can't remember.
I want to make some good enemies, though. You're not important unless you make important enemies, right? Like, I want Matt Walsh.
The only complaint he
questioning NASA was unpatriotic. I want him to attack me.
the only flack you get, Lynn, is for your technical rants at the beginning. People get triggered by those.
To complain about the software.
That's right. All right, Tony. Thanks.
All right. Peace out. Love you. Bye.
All right. There goes Tony. He's made a donation. He said he tried and tried and tried. He couldn't get it. He had technical issues himself, but he finally made it. So thank you, Tony. All right, Lynn.
We've got people in California who aren't brain dead. Isn't that great?
He's a pretty good guy. There's lots of good people everywhere.
Well, Phil's down there in what? Palm Springs?
So. He is. He's baking in the heat, global warming, whatever fakery.
I heard his rant about the vax. We'll get into that next week. Because I have been really studying the excess death numbers that Frank has provided.
I think they're real. I think they're real.
Oh, excess death numbers are the best raw stat there, the most reliable raw stat.
And I will give another number. I have a friend who only calls me, it seems, when somebody dies. He's in his 70s. And he just said his brother's wife got the, no doubt, got the clot shot. And she was diagnosed with cancer maybe 6 weeks ago, and now she's 6 feet under. So she died extremely quickly of quote-unquote turbo cancer.
Well, right, turbo cancers is what we're hearing about, that the inflammatory reaction that virtually any vaccine creates, but especially the mRNA spike proteins, apparently seems to be triggering turbo cancers in people who were otherwise in remission, right?
Well, this person didn't have anything wrong with her. She was only 75. His wife is 75, so she was perfectly healthy, and then she went downhill extremely fast. She only had one shot of chemo, but...
How old was she?
75. I know, that's sort of the average age, but still, she was perfectly healthy. And I, of course, didn't... he knows my thoughts on vaccines, and he stopped talking to me for a year or two. But now he's back, so... I said, it's okay to tell me I was right. I won't be offended that you're coming into the camp at this late stage, but no.
I want to see if RFK Jr. has any kind of impact at all on this presidential contest, whatever it is.
I think it'll be negligible, but...
I don't know, because he keeps this whole question of the vaccines, and especially the MMR, the measles, mumps, rubella, when he keeps that at the top of the radar. So, you know, that's a good thing if we want people, you know, we don't want this, we don't want the memory of the COVID to die, which is exactly what Biden and Trump would love.
Yeah.
They'd like everybody to forget all about that. And RFK Jr. at least keeps it.
Yeah, I think it's good. Yeah. Yeah. I don't even know what his stance is.
Even if he is a total hack and a junkie and everything else.
Whatever he is, I don't even know if he's for real about the vaccines.
Well, he did make his bones attacking the MMR vaccine on behalf of Children's Health Defense, which is a pretty big organization. So,
yeah. Yeah. Well, they're another very suspicious vaccine whitewashing service,
I think.
They're
all going to do the limited hangout. They're all going to say, we're not against vaccines in general.
Just bad vaccines, yeah. We just want the good vaccines, yeah.
But it opens the door. It opens the Overton window. That's the concept.
Yeah.
And once we get that, widen that opening of that Overton window, then we can pour in our challenge to virology itself as a pseudoscience.
Yeah.
And we can also raise the question of whether these experimental serums are endangering people's health and possibly their lives.
No
doubt. And triggering turbo cancers, which is a whole nother.
Oh, yes. That's a real thing. It triggers the cancer, which starts the treatments. And we know cancer treatment is 98% effective at killing people. So anyway, Lynn, thanks a lot. We will talk to you next week, and tomorrow will be Fake Nukes Phil and maybe Jim.
I'll be listening. I always listen to Phil.
All right. We'll call in. That's great. And Jim Rizzoli will probably be showing up as well before his open heart surgery, which I guess he's now on the waiting list for. So,
wow. Oh, my God.
Crazy, huh? These boomers are going down.
Yeah. Probably be me next.
No, you'll be fine. All right, Lynn. Thanks a lot, huh?
Take care.
I'll take you next. See you next week. Bye-bye. And thanks, everyone. Don't forget, we're value for value. You pay whatever this show is worth to you. Fakeologist.com/donate. We'll talk to you tomorrow with Fake Nukes Phil and Jim Rizzoli. Good night.